Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is 69 days, 11 hours, 24 minutes, 38 seconds. You know, the hours have to be off on that a little bit. Can't be 11 hours. Until George Bush is no longer president of the United States. Anyhow, it's close to that. My Bush countdown clock. Don't fail me now, old clock. Anyhow, greetings. We're going to have a great day today. In the second hour, Robert Samuelson is going to drop by, the contributing editor of Newsweek of the Washington Post. He has a new book about the great inflation of the 80s and the 70s and 80s. And I think it's going to be a fascinating conversation because he's taking sort of a Milton Friedman conservative economic view of this. And we're going to have an interesting conversation. Larry Scott will be dropping by with VAWatchdog.org today, of course, Veterans Day, as well as for Louise and I, our 36th wedding anniversary. We were married on 11-11 at 11:11 a.m. And on the third hour, Dr. John Lott is an economist, an author of Freedonomics. He's going to be talking about more guns, less crime, and the bias against guns. And his support or lack thereof, the Brady campaign's child access prevention laws. And at the bottom of this hour, Citibank's mortgage division, City Mortgage, the CEO of that corporation, citigroup.com, city.com, the website, is going to drop by and talk with us about Citicorp's new initiative to help at-risk borrowers stay in their homes, which should be interesting. Right now, Ronnie Deutsch is with us. Ronnie has been on many times in the past to just sort of to mix it up about general economics, and it's always great fun. Ronnie Deutsch is, of course, an attorney and tax expert. Ronnie, RONIDEUTCH.com is her website. Ronnie, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you for having me. It's nice talking to you. I missed you.
Well, thank you. That's very sweet of you. I always enjoy our conversations, and particularly when you start going, now, Tom, calm down. Time out, Tom. But instead of having a knockdown drag out here about economic conservative or liberal economics, I mean, we can get into that. But if you'd like. But first, serious questions. I mean, this is your area of expertise, and I feel like we've never really exploited the expertise that you have appropriately. And I mean that in a positive sense. I know that I have some, shall we say, losses in the market. There are not so much in the commodities market, let's say. And there are many others, I'm sure, who are listening to this program who have losses, some in tax-sheltered plans, 401Ks, SEPs, IRAs, things like that, many of them in simply cash that they have invested, which is pretty much how I've always done it. Never was sure I'd live long enough to cash in a 401k. So I just figured, what the hell? But wasn't sure that I would work. You know, I've retired five times in my life. But in any case, what do people do? You know, what does somebody do? My understanding is that the most that, you know, unlike a corporation, I mean, in fact, we see, you know, this as part of this bailout, the Treasury just said that banks get $140 billion windfall. Because if they buy a company that has a loss, they can take the entire loss off their profit on their spread on their balance sheet. But apparently, if an American has a loss, if a citizen, not a corporation, but an actual human being has a loss, the most that they can deduct from their taxable income is just a couple thousand dollars. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you know what, Tom? Welcome to the reality check of taxation. Right now, millions of Americans have lost huge sums of money. What are we talking? $2 trillion. Yeah. And the sad reality about our tax laws, Tom, you can only deduct your losses from your gains. Again, very simple rule. You have a ton of money that you've lost. Let's pray that you have a ton of money that you've gained. Now you get to deduct those losses. They can offset your gain. But, Tom, I don't know anyone who's made any money to offset their losses. So, unfortunately,
it would have to be the same year.
Yes, exactly, Tom.
So if last year you had stock that went up and you showed, say, a $50,000 gain and you paid cap and you cashed in that stock and or flipped it or whatever and you took the gain in that year and you paid income tax on that $50,000 gain or capital gains tax on it. This year, let's say you sold and bought that stock just to have it as a taxable event for that year. This year, that stock goes down 30-40%. You end up losing $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, depending on the individual. It could be $1,000,000. It could be, $5,000. It doesn't much matter. It's still, you end up losing a bunch of money. You can't, even though they took this big chunk of tax from you when you made a profit, when you're making a loss, it's like, good luck, Charlie. You're not a corporation.
You know what I love about your analysis, Tom, is that you are really an optimistic human being. The fact that they made money in your example is incredible. Stepping back, there is no bailout for taxpayers. We've got to get bottom line. No bailout for taxpayers. Yeah. You can only deduct $3,000 in losses every year, period.
And you can't carry it forward.
Yes, but here's the good news, Tom, and this is something that everyone has got to be aware of. We know they're not even opening their statements, Tom, and I say open the statements. You've got to know what the pain is that you are dealing with on paper. None of this matters until you sell, Tom. You and I know we've got to have the event to sell that then shows our paper loss. So the great news, yes, you only get to deduct $3,000 in capital losses. In the future, every penny of that capital loss carries forward. And you and I know, just like the 80s when we had a huge collapse, the market has been fantastic. This is a glitch. It is going to recover. We will see gains again, and you can offset your losses. But let's talk about retirement plans, because these are the calls that I'm getting, and people are confused. Here's what they're saying to me. Ronnie, I'm looking at my 401k plan, and of course I'm hysterical, I'm depressed, but I've lost a lot of money on paper, and I would like to write those off right now, Ronnie. Right now, I want to write them off. And I say to them, do not sell your 401k. That's the only way, Tom, that we're going to be able to deal with any losses. Don't sell that 401k. Look at what the age is of the person calling and listening to your show, Tom. Are you 20 years from retirement? Are you 30 years? Are you 15 years? Take a deep breath, have a few cocktails, and ride this thing out. Right. But if you are 5 years away, Tom, or 10 years away, I still don't want you cashing out the 401k plan. The tax consequences still do not outweigh it, because you got to pay the 10% penalty when you cash out early. So I say to you folks, continue to put money in your 401k plan, but demand more conservative investments, money market mutual funds, certificates of deposits, but do not do anything just for the sake of getting losses.
Yeah, and over the next year, I'm guessing that this storm is going to last at least 2 years. I mean, we're seeing, I've got some stories I'm going to share with my listeners right after the break, from the news today, but, layoffs are just spreading like metastasized cancer through this economy right now.
And
it's going to show up next year.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're bringing this up, Tom. You and I have got to be considerate of the older folks that listen to your show, because certainly they're being laid off. And the trouble, what concerns me is maybe some of them, Tom, have got some retirement accounts. And did you know that when you get to 70 and a half, you got to start taking that mandatory distribution from your retirement accounts?
Right.
Obama's going to change that law. Hey, you and I have battled over taxes, Tom, and this is one good thing about Obama. He is absolutely going to help senior citizens. They're not going to pay taxes, first of all, Tom. You make $50,000 or below, you're not paying taxes. But you do not need to worry about the mandatory distributions that seniors are having to take now. Tom, they look at their statements and they're freaking. But the law is telling them you got to take money out of your retirement accounts. Obama is going to change that. They are not going to have to take money out of their accounts. They're going to be able to let it sit and let it grow.
That's really good. Ronnie, we just have a minute left. Two quick questions. One, if the maximum deduction you can take is $3,000, shouldn't you sell at least $3,000 or enough stock to generate a $3,000 loss to take that deduction?
Absolutely, Tom. You've got to take advantage of that $3,000 rule.
Okay, so do that if it's outside of a 401k, if it's outside of something where there's a penalty, right?
Absolutely. absolutely. Outside of penalty, Tom, I want it sold imminently, and I want that $3,000 loss. Absolutely.
Right. Okay. And then secondly, the point I was starting to make before is that I think that the market might, you know, for 2 years I've been saying that this market is going to hit 7,000. I'm starting to think now it's going to hit 5,000. But whatever it hits, it's probably going to be in the middle of next year, maybe toward the end of next year. That would be the time to start buying back into equities, buying back into the stock market.
Absolutely, Tom. I love your point. Let's get back into the market when we hit that rock bottom and take advantage of carry forward losses in the future.
Right, right. But I don't think we're there yet, Ronnie. I still think that this thing has, as long as they're continuing to lay off people, that means we're sliding down because those layoffs then, you know, stop the flow of cash into the economy and that will produce. You know, we're in the downward spiral right now. So,
and again, remember this quote, fear runs deeper today than greed did a decade ago, Tom. It's going to turn itself around. I have faith.
No, it will. I do, too. Ronnie Deutsch, RONIDEUTCH.com. Thanks, Ronnie.
Tom, have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks, you too. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our quote for the day from President Theodore Roosevelt, U.S. Republican. The government is us. We are the government. You and I. Republican Teddy Roosevelt. Retail losses sap a jobs safety net. The headline on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, the U.S. retail sector is losing its place as the employer of last resort for the newly unemployed. You know the old phrase, well, you can always get a job at Walmart? No. Well, you can always get a job at Circuit City? No. Well, you can always get a job at Linen and Things? No, they've gone out of business. You can always get a job at Mervyn's? No, they just filed for bankruptcy. One out of every 10 Americans is employed in the retail sector. And since November of 2007, that is 1 year ago this month, one quarter of all those jobs have been lost. As they note in the Wall Street Journal, retail employment has traditionally been relatively resilient in times of recession. Well, it's not now. Why? Because this isn't a recession. This is the second Republican Great Depression. The first Republican Great Depression came about because the Republicans took all regulations off the sale of securities and commodities. You had a huge land bubble that started in Florida, spread across the United States. That bubble started in the early 1920s. It burst in 1927, which spread to a credit crisis in 1929, which spread to Wall Street in November of 1929, which brought down Wall Street. And then you had a Republican president who said, well, just let it work its way out. The free market will correct everything. And you had a Federal Reserve that said, we need to tighten money. We'll get into the reserve part of it with Robert Samuelson in the next hour. But basically, the bottom line, wages were falling like crazy throughout the early 30s, from 1929 to 1934. And as wages were falling, demand was falling because wages are the driver of demand. So as people lost their job, or they got paid less, there was less demand in the system. Demand is what balances or produces supply. Supply comes along to meet demand. It's really simple. And so supply fell. In other words, businesses started closing. Now, we've seen the same thing in the last 26 years. When Ronald Reagan declared war on the working class in America in 1981, when he was inaugurated as president, for the 27 years since that time, we have seen wages flat and in many cases actually declining, wages for working people declining ever since Reagan's presidency. They had been steadily growing from 1934 to 1981, steadily growing every single year, virtually without exception. if you look at five-year periods without exception. And they have been flat, relatively flat, since 1981. Why? Because of Reaganomics. So what happened? Well, supply continued increasing, and people kept buying things. Where did they get the money to buy those things? Well, it turns out in 1983, the average family was setting aside 11% a year of their money in savings. 11%! Today, the average savings, the net savings rate is minus 0.5%, half of 1%. People are spending more money than they're actually earning. I mean, that's how bad it's gotten. So at what we're seeing here, and this right across the board, and this is the direct result of Reaganomics, period. End of sentence. From today's Wall Street Journal, the marketplace section. I'll just read you the headlines. GM stock at 1946 level as dire news grows. Circuit City seeks haven and bankruptcy protection. DHL beats a retreat from the U.S. Nortel posts big losses, faces calls to break up. Plans to lay off 1,300 workers. Tough times complicate the case for buying Super Bowl ads. Those are 1, 2, 3, 4. There was only 5 headlines on the front page of the business section, the marketplace section of today's Wall Street Journal, and I just read you all 5 of them. What has happened is that demand is consumers create demand, right? Demand has been driven, from the 1930s when FDR finally in the election of 34, and it really started taking place in 35, he got a filibuster-proof majority in the U.S. Senate. And in 1935, Franklin Roosevelt put this economy back together and helped make things work. And starting in 1935, from then up until 1980, wages were steadily increasing, demand was steadily increasing, wages started flattening off in the early 1980s, and so what did people do in order to maintain their lifestyle, in order to continue paying their house payments, their mortgage payments, in order to continue paying their car payments, in order to be able to get to work, in order to be able to live in the suburbs because they didn't have cheap public education or transportation because we weren't investing in that infrastructure, what did they do? They went into debt. And we have Americans now upside down all over the place. We'll be talking with Sanjiv Das about that, CEO of City Mortgage, right after the break. But people all over the country going in debt to keep their lifestyle alive, to keep themselves alive, basically. And that debt has finally hit the wall. This is the much-discussed credit crisis. And it's going to get worse, by the way. We've seen it already with household, with mortgages. It's going to bleed into the credit card sector in the next year or so. This is all the bad news. The good news is that this is the shakeout, the cleanup that's going to get rid of this insane conservative economic theory that has gripped America like some sort of hypnotic trance since Reagan was elected and shake us back into economic sanity.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Radio for the sane among us. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. I think we're going to have to get Ronnie back on and talk about this a little more because we really just scratched the surface. A number of folks sending me notes about, you know, and the, you know, the rest of this with regard to 401ks, which I have to tell you, I know nothing about. I don't have a 401k. I never have had a 401k. So I just, you know, it's not anything I know anything about. Or have ever frankly paid any attention to. But Kate says, if you're over 55 and have lost your job, you can withdraw your 401k with no penalty and transfer it to another retirement program. I know because we had to do that when my husband lost his job 6 months ago. He put it in a Roth IRA and have had to draw from it twice so far and have suffered no penalty because of it, just an FYI. And Sue sends a note, since my IRA is down a lot, I decided to convert it to a Roth IRA and pay the taxes on the smaller amount. Yes, I will owe money when I file my tax return next year, but now I don't have to worry about paying the taxes when I retire, which is at least 20 years away. The investments are exactly the same as before the conversion. And so, anyhow, interesting points. Eric Eve is with us. Eric is the, where did it go? I just lost it. Here we go. I'm sorry. Is the Senior Vice President for Community Relations at Citigroup. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Just great. Great to have you with us. Citigroup, City Mortgage, actually, your mortgage division, is announcing a new initiative for at-risk borrowers. We have, you probably saw this piece in the New York Times today. There's a town in California where more than half of the, more than 90% of the homeowners are upside down in their mortgages.
I did see the piece, Tom.
And so what is Citibank or Citigroup doing about this?
Well, what we've announced today are two immediate and very important initiatives. One, a lot of what you see nowadays, Tom, is reaction to the crisis. What we're announcing today is that we are proactively reaching out to about 500,000 borrowers who may be at risk of going delinquent and missing payments, given the regional and national economic challenges facing us all. So step one is that we're proactively reaching out to about 500,000 homeowners around the country. The other thing that we're announcing today, which is the second part of this initiative, is we're announcing an extension of our foreclosure moratorium. If you meet four basic criteria. One, you're making a good faith effort to stay current on your mortgage payments. Two, you currently live in the home. Three, that it's a city-owned mortgage. And four, that you have a stable source of income. And so we think those two combined initiatives will help, stem some of the losses and some of the challenges facing communities around the country, Tom.
Eric, when Henry Ford was sued by a competitor back in the 30s, as I recall, the Michigan Supreme Court ruled that a corporation can't make decisions out of altruistic motives, that there has to be a good business reason behind a decision. I'm assuming that there's a good business reason behind these decisions. I mean, as much as you'd love the good PR out of it, this is also good big business sense.
Tom, you're absolutely right. This is smart for our shareholders. It's smart for communities, and it's also smart for a city. And let me tell you why. By proactively reaching out and contacting these borrowers and letting them know they do have options, yes, there will be some cost to the company and to our shareholders, but the cost is far outweighed by the risk of the alternative, right? Of these borrowers going becoming delinquent and at some point in the future possibly having to forfeit their home. So being proactive and forward-looking on the front end and investing on the front end, we're hoping to mitigate losses in the months to follow. Again, smart for the homeowner, but also smart a smart business practice for the city, and we hope that others in the industry will follow our lead here.
Eric, a lot of people are walking away from their mortgages. Or an increase, a small minority of mortgage holders, but a not insignificant number of people. And there's even a book out called Walk Away, as I recall, recommending that people do this. If somebody's hundreds or several hundreds of thousands of dollars upside down, if their mortgage is greater than the current value of their house, what do you say to those people?
Well, you know, Tom, one of the best and worst parts of my job is that I spend a lot of time in communities and talking to people just like those that you referenced, people who are now thinking about walking away. And as head of community relations for a city, we do this because the message is simple to borrowers. Yes, there's hope. Yes, you have options, and here's what they are. But the first thing you have to do is you have to pick up the phone. You must pick up the phone and contact your borrower. I don't care if it's a city mortgage or what company you're dealing with. Pick up the phone, engage in the dialogue. Industry-wide, it does not make any sense for any financial institution to foreclose on a borrower when there are other options.
Are you guys renegotiating principal?
Yes, we're taking a three-step approach. First, we're looking at the interest rate of the mortgages at step one. Step two is that we're extending many of these mortgages out to 40 years, and that comes through a lot of debate and discussion with community partners like NAACP, ACORN, the Urban League, and others. And step three, to your point, Tom, we are also, in fact, reducing the principal. The goal here is to get to an affordable product for that homeowner. So we're completely re-underwriting.
Well, and as the lender, if you can extend it to 40 years, you're going to have many more years of interest payments, and so eventually you'll make that money back even if you reduce the principal on the front end.
That's the goal here. And at the, as you know as well as I, the average life of any mortgage is about 5 or 6 years. So we hope that, you know, as
although that may change.
But right now it is to put a solution on the table, given the challenges, the economic challenges facing communities around the country.
We're talking with Eric Eve, the Senior Vice President for Community Relations at Citigroup. Eric, just one last question, and then I'll let you go. I know you've got a busy day here.
Sure.
Is there any government involvement in this effort, or is this an effort that Citigroup, Citigroup.com, by the way, Citi.com, the websites, unless there's another one that you direct people to, is this an action that you guys are taking unilaterally? Is this something that you're seeing across the industry? Is this done with or without government help?
No government help here. While we appreciate the opportunity at all times to partner with government agencies and regulators, this really builds on Citi's longstanding history and rather successful history of keeping homeowners in their homes, and really is the outgrowth of a number of nonprofit partnerships and discussions that we've had. So it's those partnerships which have helped to drive the debate and the discussion within Citi, and that's how we've evolved to this this point here today.
Was Citi? I'm sorry. One last question. Was Citi writing a lot of these? I guess they're referred to sometimes as gotcha mortgages and ninja mortgages and that kind of thing. Was Citi a subprime lender, or were you acquiring subprime loans consciously or unconsciously? Or have you always been a mainstream prime lender, and you're just finding people who are upside down because the housing value is collapsing?
It's more the latter. You ask a great question, Tom. You know, we find ourselves in a very different place from some of our peers, right? We didn't generate a lot of the toxic or exotic mortgages that some others are wrestling with. So we are in a very different position. However, it's the economic circumstance that no matter where you are on the continuum here, we're all under stress.
Right.
And so this solution, you know, addresses the family with the homeowner with the 800 FICO score and the 600 FICO score, all up and down the economic continuum. Working families are being strained in communities all across the country. So
yeah,
the goal here is to be proactive and reach out to everyone that might be struggling at this point in time,
might
offer them a solution.
Yeah, and the poster child for this, I guess, is this piece in today's New York Times. The headline, "A Town Drowns in Debt as Home Values Plunge." Mountain House, California is the name of the town. 59 feet above sea level, but the most underwater community in America. 90% of homeowners here owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. The average homeowner in Mountain House is underwater by $122,000.
My goodness.
And so you, Eric Eve, with Citigroup, and other bankers, do you see other bankers doing this, taking a proactive or at least an active role in trying to stop this from metastasizing, I guess would be a good word?
Well, we hope so. And the more that you and Air America focus on this issue, and the more your colleagues dedicate time and energy to highlighting leading practices, we hope that others will, in fact, follow suit. But today we're I'm very proud of the company today for the leadership we've provided.
I think it's a great one. It's a great one. Eric Eve, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com for our live message board, our live blog, live hangout. chat room, and our live video stream over at airamerica.com if you want to drop in. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Yeah, speaking of which, our conservative alert for the day, this a Republican congressman from Georgia. Now, you know, I lived in Georgia for 13 years. I don't want to pick too much on Georgia, but I'll tell you, there's some real whack job Republicans in Georgia. This Mr. Congressman Paul Brown, he's talking about Barack Obama, who had suggested in a speech some months ago that we need a civilian reserve corps to handle reconstruction efforts, building infrastructure, things like that, post-Katrina, all that kind of stuff. So this is this guy's response. A Republican congressman from Georgia said Monday he fears that the president-elect, Obama, will establish a Gestapo-like security force to impose a Marxist dictatorship. Paul Brown said of Obama in an interview Monday with the Associated Press, "It may sound a bit crazy and off base, but the thing is, he's the one who proposed the National Security Force." Yeah. Says, "I'm not trying to bring attention to the fact that we may not, I hope not, but we may have a problem with that type of philosophy of radical socialism or Marxism." Oh, man. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Gary in Silverton, Oregon. Hey, Gary.
Yeah.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm ready.
You're on the air.
Pardon?
Gary, you are on the air.
Oh, I'm on the air.
Yes, sir. Hey.
All right. Well, it just occurred to me that what we're at is a big monopoly game. We're at the very end of it, and one person has all the money, or the corporations, the big corporations have all the money, and nobody has any money left to spend.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's a perfect diagnosis. It is the end of a long monopoly game, and frankly, a tragic and destructive one, and it ain't good for America. It's just, you know, all around a disaster. Yeah. So, Gary, thanks a lot for the call. Stephanie, my board froze up. If you can pop Henry in line 6. Ah, there. Okay, it just unfroze. Hey, Henry, you're on the air. Hey, Henry.
Yes, sir. I'm doing fine today. Hope you all, too. But the thing I want to say is this. Being in the truck driving industry, we always are pretty much a first line to know how the economy is doing, because when things really slow down, the industry and stuff, you know, it gets really bad out here. And I have to say, out of all the years I've driven, I have to admit, this has to be the worst 2 years I have ever, you know, dealt with in the industry. Have to compete with Lowe's and everything, considering we lost almost 25% of the trucking industry due to fuel costs, companies going out of business, not able to pay that cost, and freight rates not going up any at all.
Right, not to mention the deregulation of the early 1980s, late 1970s of the trucking industry that basically threw every independent trucker out. On your own, buddy, try to compete with a big multinational corporation. And now, under the Bush administration, oh, yeah, by the way, you're also going to compete with guys coming in from Mexico.
Yeah, exactly my point. And the thing I'm saying is this. You know, Americans may look at us as nuisance on the road and things of that nature, but I'll tell you something. You lose your American trucking industry, you can find out having products and stuff for your grocery stores, shopping centers, and things of that nature almost impossible to get.
Henry, I remember it. I lived in Detroit in the early 70s, and I remember when the Arabs cut off the oil to the United States and the Teamsters called a strike as a result of Nixon's response to that, and the supermarket shelves in Detroit went naked in 2 days. It took 2 days to clear them of virtually everything. I mean, maybe you could find paper plates, but that was it. There was nothing. And that's how fast it went. And that's how fast it could go again if something like that were to happen. Henry, I got to move along, but thank you very much for your call and your kind words. Bob in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thank you. What's up?
Well, you know, I was when I came on, I was wanted to talk about the Wall Street mess, and but now that the Citigroup guy came on, I don't think they're going far enough. I applaud them for what they're doing, but I really believe that there needs to be an evaluation of the appraisal system, mm-hmm. how real estate is, yeah. is appraised. I bought a house on Cape Cod. It was a three-bedroom ranch for $220,000 in 2002. Mm-hmm. In 2006, I was appraised for $475,000.
Yeah. Yeah, we saw, you know, houses in our community selling that were comparable value to ours selling for more than twice what we paid for our house in less than 3 years here in Portland.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, yeah, and you say it's great for the homeowner, but I mean, and we did some, well, you did some improvements to the house. You know, we weatherized it, we put in new windows and things like that, but nothing that would even equal, you know, doubling the price of the house.
Yeah, and that, but that's an area that of regulation, you know, and hopefully the banks will say, okay, we need to be more conservative on these things in the future. But frankly, there needs to be a standard that is multi-generational where we don't have to worry about forgetting the lessons of when this happened the last time. Because the last time this happened in a big way was 1927 to 29 when the housing bubble burst. And it's happening again right now, and we're seeing the exact same response, the exact same consequence. And what Citibank is doing is just they're trying to stay in business. I mean, they're just doing the rational thing. And, you know, they're to be applauded, I suppose, for doing the rational thing. But geez, it's just good business practices. And that's something that we need to say. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Dave in Florida. Hey, Dave, what's up?
How you doing? You know, that guy didn't answer your question, though.
What was the question?
You know, the question about did they give any subprime loans?
Yeah, he said that that wasn't their business. And the fact of the matter is that the big banks, by and large, were not doing that. You didn't see, you know, Wells Fargo out there competing in the subprime or Citibank competing in the subprime business. That they were more the independents, these shops that got set up and broken down within a year or two, these Wild West companies, and you know, they took the hit. I mean, a lot of them are out of business now.
How come none of them are in jail?
Well, that's a good question, because we treat white-collar crime and blue-collar crime very differently in the United States, and it's wrong, David. I'm not justifying that, but it's also a fact, you know, it's that by and large, if somebody robs a bank by using a computer or a pen and they work for the bank or they are a lawyer or something like that, they're not going to get anything close to what if you or I were to walk into a bank with a note and a phony bomb or a gun or something. Even if we only got $5, we would get. And it's the way it is. People say, well, America's a classless society. No, we're very much a class society. And we need to acknowledge that. And we need to, as you say, you know, let's start putting some of these white-collar criminals in jail. Great plan. Coming up next, Robert Samuelson.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Robert J. Samuelson is on the line with us. No relation to The Economist. He is the reporter and writer. He writes a columnist for Newsweek magazine, The Washington Post. He has a new book out, The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath. And Robert J. Samuelson, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Your book is a fascinating, and today is the release date, by the way, a fascinating insight into the what you refer to as the Great Inflation. I think most Americans would blink and say, huh, if you said that to them of the 1970s, 1980s. Give us the frame for this.
Well, you're right. First, that most 60% of Americans are 35 and under, and for them, this is not a real memory. But essentially what happened is in the 60s and the 70s, we went from stable prices, and in 1960, 61, price increases were about 1%, negligible, hardly noticeable. By the end of the 70s, we were at 13% and double digits, and people did not know whether it would go higher. They feared that it would, and they expected it would. So we went from a situation where we essentially had a stable price regime to one where we had double-digit inflation and people expected it to continue almost indefinitely.
Right, and I remember those times quite well.
Oh, I do too.
let's define inflation first off, because it seemed, frankly, it seemed to me that your definitions were at times changing or a little ambiguous. Inflation is, let me just toss this out and let you either challenge it or agree with it. Inflation is not rising prices. That is a symptom of inflation. Inflation is a decline in the value of a currency.
Well, I would say that's a tautology. And the important thing, I think, is to recognize that inflation is not just the increase of one or two prices. It's not just the increase of the price of oil or the price of food or whatever. It's a general rise in the price level, which by its effect is a depreciation in the currency in terms of what it will buy. So the value of a dollar, it goes down. If you have, for example, I mean, you take a hypothetical example here, you might have the price of oil going up as it did up until quite recently, but you might have other prices that were going down so that the average price level wasn't changing at all. That's not inflation.
Right,
inflation is when you have average prices going up and the value of the currency that's either in your bank account or in your pocket is going down.
Right, and that's why I'd say it's not a tautology.
Yeah.
It's because, I mean, there are some things that are going to rise or fall in, as a consequence of supply, demand, or innovation. You know, computers, for example, or
exactly.
Oil, for example, as we hit peak oil in the United States in the 70s. But you talk about the rise in productivity, for example, from 1960 to 2005. And you note that the wages during that period rose an average of 1.5% and productivity rose an average of 1.9%. But this is really where I think the breakout falls apart. You know, Greenspan was obsessed with what he referred to as wage inflation. He saw inflation as being wage inflation. And from 1980 till today, we've seen wages not rising, which is why that 1.5% average from 1960 is lower than the average for productivity. And the result of this, and by the way, you acknowledge this in the book. You talk about how personal savings were at 11% in 1982. They're zero today. They're actually minus 0.5%. The 2006 household debt was 134% of personal annual income. But what happened over this 26-year period since Reagan declared war on working people and wages started flattening out is that in order to continue, even though productivity has continued to increase uninterrupted, is that if productivity represents supply and wages represent demand, as wages flattened off, in order for demand to meet supply, or the other way around, people, instead of paying wages to meet what was supply to maintain their standard of living, they started spending debt. They started going into debt. And now we've hit the wall, people, that wall of debt. It seems to me that that's missing from your analysis.
Just a couple of things. First place, the figures here are, it was not a 1.5% increase in wages. It was a 1.5% annual increase in the labor force, which was mainly people coming into the labor force because they were also, on average, working fewer hours on average.
Okay.
So economic growth over this period averaged a little bit over 3% annually.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit more than half of that reflected increased productivity gains, what most people would call efficiency. And the other part of it, the 1.5%, reflected increase in working hours and labor. What happened during this period? During the period of the late 70s, living standards essentially stagnated because productivity stagnated. And I argue in the book that the probable cause of this was a higher inflation, which distracted managers and businesses from paying attention to how they ran their businesses and focus their attention on how much and how often they should increase their prices, because that became more important to their profitability than increasing underlying productivity. Since the early 1980s, as inflation came down, companies have been forced to look at their underlying efficiency and effectiveness more, because that's the only way they could increase their profits, since they couldn't really raise their prices very much. And so they've tended to look more at that. But it's hard, as a strictly intellectual matter, to say what caused productivity increases or stagnation, because productivity reflects so many different factors. It reflects technology, the competence of management, worker skills and motivations, the extent of competition, the state of the business cycle. So we know what productivity increases and when it stagnates, and we can speculate about the causes, but we really can't in any rigorous way identify, it's very difficult to identify a single cause because it reflects so many different things.
We're talking to Robert J. Samuelson. His new book, The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. There are some economists who are suggesting that much of the productivity gains we've seen over the last 20 years have been the consequence not of any brilliance in American management or increase, for that matter, in productivity of the American worker, but the fact that, say, you've got a company with 100 employees and 20 of those people are engaged in back office functions, a phone bank or accounting or something like that. You offshore that to India, and now you have 80 employees, but the company is still a $20 million company, and it still is generating the same turnover, the same revenue that it was generating before. Its costs overall have gone down somewhat, and it's lost 20% of its labor force, so the rest of its labor force is counted as being that much more, one-fifth more productive.
Well, but its costs have gone up because it has to pay for the inputs that it's buying from India or wherever, where it's at.
No, but I'm assuming that those costs are less than the cost of labor that it's losing by laying those people off.
Well, and they may well be. And
otherwise, they wouldn't do it.
Otherwise, you would think they wouldn't do it, although companies have been known to make stupid decisions in the past and probably will make stupid decisions in the future.
Sure.
But when calculating their productivity, you basically look at the value added of the company and the increase and the labor hours that went into that value added. There has been offshoring. There's no doubt there's been offshoring, but it's not been huge. The studies that look at this discovered that the offshoring of these kind of services has not been huge. And there's one thing that the American economy has been good over time, and that is creating jobs. And I'm just looking to get those figures now, but job creation over time has not been a problem for the American economy. It's right, obviously right now it is a problem, and during recessions it is a problem, but that hasn't been
In the abstract, but if you define job creation as jobs that a person can raise a family on, I'd say it's been pretty bad since 1981.
Well, part of the problem that we have, people feel their incomes are squeezed almost all the time. And part of the reason for that is that our wants and desires and the things that we can buy go up. I mean, healthcare gives you a lot more today than it did 30 or 40 years ago, but it's a lot more expensive. People expect to have internet service today where they didn't expect it or even know about it in 1980. They expect to own a cell phone. They expect to have a widescreen TV. They expect to own personal computers. So the fact that all the things that we can buy, the range of things we can buy goes up, creates additional pressure on our incomes. People have been able to afford this, but they afford it with extra anxiety.
Robert J. Samuelson, his book, The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. Thank you for being with us, sir.
Oh, thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour, it's Veterans Day, and Larry Scott, the editor and founder of VAWatchdog.org, is on the line with us. Larry, thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And we all owe a great debt of thanks to all of the active and what's the word? I guess veterans, active service military and our veterans.
Well, veterans and soon to be veterans, we could call the other ones.
There you go.
Our active duty folk, yes.
Larry, you and I were talking a little earlier this morning about the state of affairs for veterans, and you shared some startling statistics with me. Would you do that for our listeners now, please? About the bunnies?
Oh, well, people have a feeling that, you know, we talk about supporting our troops and supporting our veterans, and one of the reasons veterans' issues have been put on a back burner, Tom, is because really there aren't that many veterans in this country anymore, just about 23 million. That's less than 8% of the population. Veterans using VA hospitals this year will be less than 2% of our population. Veterans who get disability checks every month, less than 1% of the population. And I was talking to a friend up on Capitol Hill the other day, and we were talking about the declining influence of veterans, and it was pointed out that there are more pet rabbit owners in this country than there are veterans who use VA hospitals. And in his mind, he would say it's astounding that pet rabbit owners could have a stronger lobby than veterans who need health care. But that's kind of where we find ourselves these days. There's a lot of verbal support, and that is, you see the stickers, support our troops, support our veterans. But when it comes down to real power, unfortunately, the veterans' influence is diminishing as the population diminishes.
Now, tell me if I'm off on some wild, crazy, cockamamie conspiracy theory here.
Not you, Tom. Never.
As I tend to do from time to time, Larry, or if you think that this is solid. We brought into power in 1980 with Reagan, and we saw it come full flower with George W. Bush, the idea that government is not the source of succor, of help for American people. It is the cause of the problems for American people. And therefore, all things government should be reduced. Presumably, that would include the military as well. Not necessarily spending on military expenses, but the number of people whose paychecks are being written as government paychecks. And so we replaced, for example, in Iraq, we replaced the cooks and the food service people and the mail delivery people that used to be done by soldiers. And it was a good thing that was done by soldiers, because if a camp or a base got overrun, those cooks could grab their rifle and suddenly they're part of the fighting force, rather than the people who are the fighting force having to pull themselves back from combat to protect the cook.
Right.
Those cooks could become part of the fighting force and onward it would go. And this is something that literally goes back to ancient Greece. You know, Napoleon organized his army this way. George Washington organized his army this way. I had a woman on this show 2 years ago whose son died because Halliburton had decided they didn't want to deliver mail for a week or two because in Iraq, because the road to the airport was too dangerous. And so he drove that road to try and get his mail. He thought he was expecting something from home, and he died on that road, and she was just wretched about it. Had the army been delivering the mail, it would have gotten through. It always has.
And that's because the military was not doing the military's job, Tom. There's no conspiracy theory here at all. It's a matter of the way our government, especially over the last 8 years, has been doing business. Smaller government is better government. But the problem is that really makes no sense, just as you pointed out with the military. When I was in, we had military cooks, we had military drivers, and again, those people were part of the fighting force if needed. But what we find is it is really a ridiculous way to do business, because not only do you diminish the strength of your force, it costs more in the long run. We've seen these contractors over in Iraq and Afghanistan doing the same jobs the GIs could do and should be doing, getting 4, 5, 6, 8 times the pay. So this whole concept of smaller government, if we outsource it, is a myth. It's a lie. And I know you've talked about this many times, but this is especially important with the military. We had what they call the chow hall fiasco in Iraq, where a contractor said, okay, everybody eats at the same time and you all come into this tent. They had rocket-propelled grenades come in. A number of our GIs were killed. Instead of doing it the old military way of eating in small groups of 2 or 3 and you stagger your eating times and you don't give the enemy a target. So not only does it cost more, but it puts our troops in harm's way because these people don't know what they're doing.
Right. And do you see, Larry, in the half minute we have left here, do you see a revisiting of that idiotic worldview?
No, actually, what I see and what I hear from friends in the veteran service organizations is that they are extremely hopeful that the Obama administration is going to take a look at this very, very closely. They're going to make the military the military. They're going to do more to take care of the veterans, to fully fund veterans health care. That is one of the promises Barack Obama made when he was on the campaign trail. And I think what you're going to see is a complete shift, not only in veterans' health care, but in the way the military is run as well, and it will be for the better.
Well, let's hope so.
I hope so.
I do, too, and I actually think that that's going to be the case as well. I think we've seen ideology run nuts and a nutty ideology to begin with. Larry Scott, the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, for all things veterans, get over to VAWatchdog.org right now. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270. In
the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here, 34 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Dan in Phoenix, Arizona, you want to defend the appraisers?
Every time I hear someone call up about, you know, complaining about their value of their home that it was 2 years ago, I want to try and just tell people that the appraisal is done as of that date and that time. And if, for example, you were looking at the stock market, you look at the stock market and oil prices are now at $60 a barrel. Well, that's what they're worth today. It's not what they're worth tomorrow. It's not what they're worth 2 years from now. It's the same thing that goes with a house. So when someone calls up and says, well, you know, I want to go after these appraisers because they appraised my home for way more than what it was worth. Well, the appraisal was done 2 years ago, and it was worth that much 2 years ago. Today, it's not.
Yeah, that's a good point, Dan. Now, I think the criticism that is a more legitimate criticism, and correct me if you disagree, is of the mortgage lenders who were not even using appraisers.
We
had a number of subprime lenders who were simply doing in-house appraisals, or they had people doing not even drive-by appraisals, you know, doing computer-based appraisals or whatever. I mean, just, you know, quick and dirty, back of the envelope, just slap a number in there, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were basically using a credit score, which was way, way below what the threshold should have been. But they were going off of a 680 credit score and saying, oh, we don't need an appraisal. We can just go ahead and give you a loan for whatever you need and go ahead and tell me what you make.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you what you make, and you just sign right here. And that's the people that need to be going after. These are the people that the mortgage brokers, the mortgage loan originators, those are the people who aren't licensed, who will be supposedly licensed by 2010, which I think is ridiculous that they're not making that happen sooner. But us appraisers have a license to protect. And when someone comes across and says, you know, hey, I think that this appraiser committed fraud, well, basically what you're telling me is that my job is nothing but fraud. Because every day that I go out and I do an appraisal, I'm providing my opinion of value. And back then, doesn't mean that my opinion of value was fraud back then.
Right.
It just means that I was reporting what it was.
Right. It's a classic example of shooting the messenger.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, what you guys were reporting was that there was a bubble going on, and that's a macroeconomic problem, not the microeconomic problem of, you know, what's the house worth next door to this house right here in this neighborhood.
Yeah, and unfortunately, most of us aren't economists and qualified to predict that there's a bubble, nor are we, you know, supposed to predict. I mean, we're
right.
Only telling you what it's worth today, not what it's worth 6 months from now. And that's another thing is these builders were shoving loans down people's throat with six-month-old
yep.
appraisals. Especially in early 2007, I had several clients. I'm also an agent. I had several clients that I had to aggressively negotiate prices down because the prices that they're closing properties at were so much lower. But now, you know, I had them dropping $40,000, and those homes are now worth, you know, probably a third what they were sold for back then. But, I mean, that's a different story altogether.
Yeah. So, by and large, you're of the opinion that there was very little fraud. There weren't appraisers who were over-appraising simply because they wanted to make a fee from a hustling subprime lender.
We're at the bottom of the barrel. We make the smallest fee and have the most liability.
I see.
I mean, and everybody wants to come after and witch hunt on the appraisers, and it really gets sickening after a while. I mean, because all everybody thinks appraisers are dirty. I even go out and do appraisals, and I was actually doing one on a purchase, a new build, and I ran into a utility company guy who was coming out to turn the power on. He's like, "Hey, are you one of those guys that were, you know, jacking up the house prices?" And I'm like, "Come on." Yeah. No, I turned those over to the other people that were, you know, okay with jacking up house prices.
Yeah, okay. Dan, a good and vigorous defense. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
And well said. Christian in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Christian.
Hi. I was listening to you talk to the guest about inflation, the guy that had just written a book. And I've had an idea, and I'm curious what you think. Would it make sense to tie wages to inflation? Because if the price of everything goes up, but wages go up with it, it's my thinking that people who are stuck in these upside-down mortgages would be paying a smaller percentage of their income towards their debt, just like we do when the value of the currency drops in the U.S. overall when we have to pay off China.
Yeah. The area where I, you know, it probably wasn't apparent from the conversation we had because it was, frankly, too slow and too wonky, but I pretty much disagree with much of Robert Samuelson's book and many of his conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with his definition of inflation. He's in my opinion, defining inflation as rising prices, and I would take a far more monetarist view and say, no, it's a decrease in the value of money, and we need to look at M3 and things like that. He suggests in his book that cap and trade, for example, he's opposed mm-hmm. to cap and trade. He says it's going to drive up the cost of carbon-based fuels, and that's going to be inflationary. And I would say, you know, it's not inflationary if you're not debasing your currency. It is simply increasing the price of one commodity, in this case, energy, which is a major commodity. And, yes, it may increase prices throughout the economy that have to do with energy, but not necessarily everything, A. And, B, it might actually lead to a drop in energy prices because it might cause that pop where somebody says, hey, look at this. If we just add a little molybdenum to this solar panel, we can increase its efficiency by 500%. And suddenly we've got a brand new energy source.
Hmm.
You know, much like, you know, the price of whale oil was increasing dramatically in the middle 1800s, I mean, which was used for lighting all over the United States, all over the world, the developed world. And as the whales were getting wiped out, and the price of whale oil went through several 100% increases over, you know, 4 or 5 year periods. And, you know, when kerosene came along after 1856 or 1865, I mix up my years, when Colonel Drake drilled the first oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and we started the naphtha and then the kerosene industries, we saw the price of heating or lighting oil just collapse, right? It dropped. It dropped dramatically. It became much less expensive to light your home. And suddenly people were building chandeliers for oil, you know, lamps and lighting entire rooms rather than just corners of rooms and things like that because we came up with a new energy source or a new lighting source. And I think that the same thing would happen. I disagree with him on that. He talks about how entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, these things in his book, bemoans the fact that if we're actually going to, fulfill the obligations to the generation that is retiring and the generation after that, that will be retiring, people anywhere from 30 to 70 right now, if we're actually going to fulfill our commitments to them, that we may see tax rates go as high as 50%, and that'll kill our economy. And I would say, wait a minute, you've got 50% tax rates in almost all the European countries, and their economies are not only not killed, they're healthier than ours are.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, it's, I mean, he takes this monetarist approach when he agrees with Milton Friedman and ignores monetarism when he disagrees with him, and I just find the book, you know, I have some problems with it, and I would encourage people to read it and make up their own mind. But there's an excerpt from it in the current issue of Newsweek, which is promoting it, of course, because he's basically putting out the conservative memes that, you know, let's privatize Social Security kind of thing. But it didn't work out, frankly, as the kind of debate I was hoping it would, because both of us were, I think, far too convoluted in our, we were working too much around the levels of the details.
One last comment. Yeah. Also, would it make any sense then to try to tie wages in the U.S. to the rise in prices of goods? Because I think of things like trying to put tariffs on import items from China so that American workers can compete. But then that'll raise the price of everything at Walmart. But if our wages are tied to a rise in prices, then it won't hurt the consumer and the American worker could compete.
But see, here's, you don't need to do that, Christian. And here's why. And this is where, the marketplace actually is. I mean, there is a real concept here of the marketplace. I think attaching the word free to it is stupid, but there is a real marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
If we put up tariffs, so let's say that we put up a 20% import tariff on anything that you can manufacture in the United States, just right across the board, which, by the way, would be about a third lower than the historic tariffs in the United States right up until the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
from the founding of this country until the 1980s. So let's say we put up a 20% tariff, and so the price of everything in Walmart goes up by 20%. What that's going to do is, for many of those items that can be inexpensively produced in the United States, it's going to create an immediate demand within this country for the manufacturer of those items, which means the factories are going to start back up again, which means that there's going to be jobs. When you see more jobs, more entrepreneurs starting factories and looking to hire people, more jobs than there are workers, what happens is the price of labor starts going up significantly. So when you see that if you put those tariffs into place, yes, the cost of things in Walmart is going to go up 20%, but your paycheck is going to go up 40%.
Got it.
And just as the reverse is the case, you do away with the tariffs, hey, the price of stuff in Walmart went down 20%, but my paycheck went down 40%.
Mm-hmm.
Because the stuff that you buy in Walmart is only a small percentage of what your paycheck buys. And so, this is the trap that Alan Greenspan got caught in. He was hysterical about what he referred to as wage inflation. He ignored CEO wage inflation. He thought worker wage inflation was the only thing to worry about. And in 1998, he even talked to the Wall Street Journal about how he saw his principal job as being to increase in interest rates during times of strong economic growth so that the economy would soften, so that there would be fewer jobs, there would be less demand, there would be fewer jobs, because when the number of jobs started approaching the labor force, the amount of the labor force, the demand for labor started driving up the cost of labor, and he wanted to prevent that from happening. Now, he said he wanted to prevent that from happening because he thought it was inflationary. I believe that he wanted that to stop that from happening because he didn't want there to be a strong middle class, because he's a classical conservative, and they, most of them are pretty upfront about this, that when you have a strong economic middle class, they will create what conservatives refer to as social instability. Minorities will start demanding rights. The middle class will start demanding, equal access and freedom and things like that. It's just kind of messy.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
I'm a sleepwalker. I'm a sleepwalker, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I don't know where I'm going, and I don't know what I'm chewing. I'm a sleepwalker, and I'm stumbling and shaking, and I don't know how I got here, and I don't know when I'm
leaving. I think it's the official George W. Bush song there. 9.5 minutes before the hour. And our piggies away.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white
shirts? The piggies with the starched white shirts.
The piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts.
Oh, yes, our piggy of the day, Senator Norm Coleman. Turns out that according to a recent lawsuit, now this is all an allegation at this point, Nazar Kazemini, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, claims that he was actually not trying to give that $75,000 to Norm Coleman's wife. No, he actually was trying to have his company, DMT, make quarterly cash payments of $25,000 directly to Senator Norm Coleman. Unfortunately, that was illegal, so he tried to route it through his wife, quoting from the lawsuit, quote, because DMT, which services offshore oil platforms and port facilities, oh, man, already used Aon for its insurance.
You will find the figures stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play around.
Norm Coleman, who no doubt is going to lose the recount, our piggy of the day. By the way, there was a story. This is our science wonky alert for the day. I don't have science wonky news yet or music yet for it. We're going to get some. Anyhow, the story, you probably saw this. It was all over all the newspapers. Every newspaper in America carried this story because it was being pushed really hard by the one of the companies behind this study and that makes one of the drugs that was promoted in this study. Was this the Stanford University study that says, or no, it wasn't Stanford. It was, it was Stanford University, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, said that the simple blood test looking for C-reactive protein, which is an indication, $20 test, an indication of inflammation in the body. They took 18,000 volunteers who had high levels of C-reactive protein in 26 countries over a two-year period, and put them on, half of them on a statin drug, on a cholesterol-lowering drug, and the other half on a placebo, on a sugar pill. And at the end of 2 years, they actually stopped the study a couple of years early because they said that, quoting from the newspaper story, about half of all heart attacks, where's the actual? A simple blood test can spot an increased risk for a heart attack or stroke in seemingly healthy people. And they stopped the study early because they said that overall death rates were 20% lower than in the placebo groups, and there were 50% fewer heart attacks and strokes. Now, that seems pretty startling. And when I read that, I thought, whoa, this is incredible. I mean, I should run out and get myself on Crestor right now. So I thought, maybe I ought to check this thing out. I'm a member of AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and get Science Magazine as a consequence of that. And so I went to their website. AAAS.com, or sciencemag.org, and science.com, I think, is their website, the main website. But anyhow, for this AAAS Science Magazine, cholesterol drug tackles inflammation, because what they were saying is that this drug was reducing inflammation because they were looking at C-reactive protein, this inflammation marker. This drug reduces inflammation, therefore reducing inflammation will stop heart attacks and strokes. And I thought, well, why not just take aspirin? It's a lot cheaper. And it doesn't have all the side effects of these statin drugs. I have a friend who was crippled by taking statin drugs. Literally crippled. I mean, his muscles started wasting away, and he was in excruciating pain for 3 years after he quit taking it. So I went and I read, the study and the article about the study, the science one. It turns out that the number of people was statistically significant, but out of 18,000 people, 157 had a cardiac event during the study compared to 83 people taking the drug. So we're talking about, fewer than 100 people was the difference out of 18,000, number one. Number two, the drug itself was producing significant side effects. And number three, and this is where it gets really weird, this is called sample bias. While study participants were described as healthy volunteers, most were also overweight, 15% were current smokers, and 40% had metabolic syndrome. These risk factors and not C-reactive protein may explain why having more aggressive cholesterol-lowering goals can help. In other words, if those people had simply stopped, changed their diet and exercise, you would have seen the same result or maybe even better. So be careful about how you read the news. I just it's science is what you make of it, right? Gabriella in Los Angeles. Hey, Gabriella, what's on your mind today?
Oh, thank you, Tom. Nothing to do with what you spoke about, but thank you for bringing that point up, just educating ourselves. I have a question with parts to it regarding the flat tax. I've always been confused about this, and I've heard wonderful possibilities as well as horror stories of what could happen if we did a 10 to 15% across the board for earned income for individuals. And what I was wondering is, if we deduct nothing, if we have no deductions left, no dependents, homes, charitable contributions, and would this affect every strata of the economic, from top to bottom? And how would this affect corporations? And who would benefit the most? And I would just like your take on that.
Well, flat tax is in its essence, there's a reason why people like Steve Forbes, why all the billionaires want there to be a flat tax. Because instead of paying the current 32 or 33 or 34, whatever it is, percent top marginal tax rate, they would all love to pay 17%. So the billionaires want the flat tax. On the other hand, people who are living in poverty, people who are working at 7-Eleven and Walmart, people who are making so little money that they don't pay income taxes right now, would really rather not start paying 17% or whatever it's going to be. There's some indications that for a flat tax to actually work, it would have to be more like 20%. What a flat tax does is it shifts a massive part of the payment of the costs of the commons of government from the shoulders of billionaires and multimillionaires onto the shoulders of the poorest of the working people and the average of the working people. And that's why the millionaires and billionaires are all out there pushing the flat tax, and that's why it's a bad, bad, bad idea. We have a progressive tax system in the United States. It took us a long time to get it. Abraham Lincoln, actually, was the first advocate of a progressive tax system. He put one in place to help pay for the Civil War. It only took effect on people with incomes, as I recall, over $5,000 a year, which is a lot of money back then. Let's stay with it. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, what to do with Joe Lieberman? There's so much in the news. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Joe Lieberman, the progressive who lost his way? You know, Joe Lieberman votes about 70% of the time with the Democrats. I think that Barack Obama's call to Harry Reid yesterday saying, let him stay in the Democratic caucus, was actually the right move. I think that Joe Lieberman has gone. He went with John McCain in part because he agrees with McCain's worldview vis-a-vis the Middle East and Iraq and the U.S. having a muscular foreign policy. He went with John McCain in part because he and John McCain are old and dear friends. And frankly, I think he went with John McCain in part because he's still upset that the people of Connecticut rejected him for Ned Lamont. They said, no, we'd rather have this young business guy than you, Joe Lieberman. And he's still stinging about that. But the old saying of, you know, keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer, I think really and truly does apply here with regard to Joe Lieberman. It very much applies here. Other things in the news today. The GOP is melting down. At least that's how it looks from the outside. You know, Newt Gingrich fighting with the Romney faction, fighting with the Huckabee faction, Sarah Palin, she's going to come into the governor's conference and give a keynote speech, blah, 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 blah. What's the new? Here's the problem. First of all, these guys are really toxic, and they're not going to go away. Anybody who thinks that the GOP has been defeated is just plain old flat out wrong, and we have to strongly, in my opinion, be prepared for them to reinvent themselves and come back. They're going to try to come back with the same old memes. The old Ronald Reagan, government isn't the help, government's the problem, you know, as he said in his first inaugural. And, you know, the nine most dangerous words, I'm from here, government, I'm here, all that kind of stuff. They're going to try and trot that stuff out. But by and large, that stuff doesn't work anymore. Because Americans have discovered, have come to realize, that in the United States, as Teddy Roosevelt said, our quote for the day, the government is us. We are the government, you and I. And no matter how much Reagan, you know, he had to have a boogeyman out there. You have to, this is the first rule of fiction. When you learn to write a novel or a screenplay, first rule, your hero can only be as good as the anti-hero, the antagonist is evil. So if you're going to have a strong hero, you have to make sure that you have a strong opponent, a strong anti-hero. Just think how boring Superman would have been if there was no Lex Luthor. If he didn't have a super villain to go up against. Think how boring Batman would be if he didn't have all these super villains. Or Spider-Man. Well, Ronald Reagan needed to have a real, strong, evil force that he was fighting against. And the Soviet Union just pretty much didn't make it anymore because by 1980, everybody had gotten it that the Soviet Union was disintegrating. I mean, since the mid-60s, the CIA had been predicting that within a decade, the Soviet Union would collapse economically. Anybody who had traveled to any of the former Soviet satellite countries or East Germany could come back and tell you horror stories about how communism was failing. Our proxy war against communism in Vietnam had failed. So Reagan had to find another enemy. And that other enemy, he decided, would be the United States of America. Think about this. These guys ran on the platform of America is bad. That was the essence of Reaganism. That's been the essence of the Republican message since 1980, that America is bad. That we are that it doesn't work. And frankly, I think it's come to an end. Hey, I see that John Lott, Dr. John R. Lott is with us. I didn't know that you'd come on, and nobody let me know. Are you on the line there?
I am. How are you doing?
Hey, John, I'm fine. JohnRLott.blogspot.com is the website, and we didn't have you at the beginning of the hour, so usually we just move on. But anyhow, so welcome to the show. First of all, you just heard my rant about Reagan. You've got on your blog at JohnRLott.blogspot.com. You've got a nice little homage to Ronald Reagan, a collection of put-together pieces from his first inaugural. I would encourage both conservatives and liberals to watch it because I think it really highlights those issues that I was just raising. You want to respond to me?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think Reagan had a pretty bright and happy image of the United States. I think it's hard for me to know exactly what you're referring to when you say that he had a very grim image of the country. I thought he...
Well, here's his own words, you know, for example.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Now, Teddy Roosevelt, on the other hand, said the government is us. We are the government, you and I.
Right, but it's because Reagan thought that people were able to best handle these things on their own, that they knew what their problems were. That doesn't mean he thought America was bad. I think he had an overall very positive image of America. But
Reagan hated the American government. The American government is us.
Well,
it's us.
It's part of us, but it's not all of us. Most people still today.
It's all of us.
We all
have We're all Americans here, John.
We have some part in the government, but your life is not all about the government.
No, and I'm not. Nobody I know would suggest it should be.
No, but the point is.
But to say that America is evil, like Reagan did over and over
The
American government is evil, and that there's somehow something that is separate. You know, in that inaugural, in the clip that you've got on your website, he says, you know, America is a country that has a government, not the other way around, and that differentiates us from every other country in the world. Remember that clip? It's not true.
But the quote he was saying, he wasn't saying that the government's evil. He's just saying that they're not helpful, that they cause problems. He's not saying that they're not well-meaning. He's just saying what they try to do creates more problems than it helps. And that doesn't say anything about America being evil at all. And it surely there's a lot more, even if he were to say the government was evil, which he wasn't, there's a lot more to the United States than the government. The government may make up 20%, federal government may make up 20% of revenue for the country and may make up 23-24% of spending. But that still leaves a lot of spending and a lot of money out there that the government isn't controlling.
Well, and it's a fine thing. I'm a big believer in the free enterprise system, John, as are you. But I would submit to you that the Republican Party is bankrupt because their days of running against the concept, the founding concepts of this nation, the ideas that the ideals, frankly, that the founders put together when they said that we are creating a government with a very specific purpose. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare with a capital W, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. They didn't say we're going to refuse to create a government for this country.
No, but general welfare there meant something different than I think you're implying here. It meant programs that only benefit the country as a whole, not helped certain particular parts. They would have been against having some type of bailout just for General Motors. They would have been against a lot of programs that would have helped just particular segments of the country. They would have been for, I mean, look at what government they did have then. They were for a much more limited government than we have today, and I think that's the point of Reagan. But you talk,
John,
about
I would suggest if you really and truly believe that, you should go back and read the deliberations of the Constitution. You know, James Madison's notes on the deliberations.
Right.
You know, our government was writing checks from its foundation to pay for widows and orphans, for destitute people. We had welfare systems. George Washington was writing welfare checks.
Well, as a percentage of GNP, the federal government was basically about 2 to 3% of GNP from the beginning of the country through to World War I. You'd have exceptions when you had a war, but then as soon as the war was over, it'd go back to 2 to 3%. The government now is about 10 times bigger than it was over virtually all of our history.
Yeah, and the biggest transition happened after the Civil War, when we went from a strong state, weak federal government system before the Civil War to a strong federal government, weak state system after the Civil War. And I think most Americans think that that was a good thing.
No, well, there are two points that we're making here. One is what the founders envisioned, which was a weak central government. Okay?
Some of the founders. Jefferson did, for example. Not Alexander Hamilton, who thought
I'm saying even in practice, up until World War I, not just after the Civil War, from the beginning of the country up until World War I, it was 2 to 3% of GDP.
John, you want to stick around for a minute? We'll continue the conversation.
Sure. I can't stay too long, but I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, we'll take it to the bottom of the hour. Dr. John Arlott is with us. He's an economist, the author of Freedonomics, More Gun, Less Crime, and The Bias Against Guns. Let's talk about guns. JohnArlott.blogspot.com is his website. And we'll be right back. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Checkered past, what's all this interrogating, baby? Forget about that. You don't want to ask no questions you don't know the answer to. You might wish that I was lying once you heard the brutal truth. I can think of a thousand things I'd rather do than you, and the time that it would take me to explain the way I am. Honey, I could be well on my way to being your new man. We could waste a day.
Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. That's something I suspect John Lott and I can agree the founders did not have in mind. We're talking with Dr. John R. Lott. He's the author of Freedonomics.
Freedonomics. Right.
Thank you. And website, johnrlott.blogspot.com. John, in 2004, 16,750 people committed suicide in the United States with guns. Among people under 20, two people every day commit suicide using guns. In a household with firearms, in a state with higher than the norm firearm ownership, suicide victims, particularly teenagers, are twice as likely. You have twice as many suicide victims, twice the suicide rate as you have in low firearm states. The unintentional firearm death rate, related death rate for children 0 to 14 is 9 times higher in the U.S. than in the 25 other most developed countries combined. The risk of homicide in a home is 3 times greater in a household with a gun. The risk of suicide is 5 times greater in a household with a gun. Will you join with me? And I say this as a guy who loves to shoot guns. And, in fact, in a couple of weeks when I get out to Michigan, my brother and I are going to do what we always do when I get there, and we're going to go down into to the shooting range, and he's got a whole collection of handguns and just do some competitive shooting. Will you join with me and the Brady campaign in calling for safe storage laws that say that if a child obtains an improperly stored, loaded gun, the adult owner is criminally liable, and that guns, if they are being stored in a home, must be stored, particularly if they're loaded, in a way that is either A, reasonably inaccessible to children, or B, locked with a safety device?
Right. No, I wouldn't, because I think it actually results in more deaths. You know, your listeners, if they're interested, can go to the Centers for Disease Control website. They have mortality morbidity report section that has amazingly detailed data on accidental gun deaths, suicides, all sorts of things by year of age, by state, by type of gun, where it occurred. If you want to look at children with accidental gun deaths for age under 10, for most of the last decade, you're talking about something in the 20 range, 20 cases a year. The most recent year it was 38, but that's unusually high. If you look at for kids under age 15 over the last 10 years, most of the time it's going to be in the 50s. There's one case recently where it's as high as 72. But look, you know, I would like the number of deaths to be zero, whether it's in the 20s or 50s or what have you.
Let me just understand the logic of this, John. If you leave or if I leave
right.
the keys to my car in my car, and you know I leave the car idling and the door unlocked, and I walk away from the car near some city park, and some 12-year-old hops in the car and puts it in gear and mows down a pedestrian, who should go to jail?
Well, I think there's a little bit of difference here. And one of the big differences is that when you go and you lock up a gun, you make it difficult for someone to use a gun defensively. And what you find is that when states have passed these laws, I have a couple academic papers written on this, do you find that criminals become more emboldened to attack people in their home and that successful crimes increase?
John, you know that there are gun locks out there that you can unlock, assuming that you have the key available to you, in less than 2 seconds.
Well,
and what we could do here is create a whole new market for keys with a chain on them and a little hook that goes on your belt or something, or maybe even somebody could invent something even cooler than that. You know, it's like halfway up your shirt sleeve or something. You can just pop the key out, boom, and unlock your gun right away.
Yeah, well, first of all, any of the locks that you're talking about are going to require that the gun be unloaded. You're going to have to store the key and the gun in separate places if the key is going to have any benefit with regard to
Right, I'm
that.
Saying store the key on your person.
Right. Well, I'm just saying, you see, it can make
so that's
difficult.
Where I store my car keys. I mean, I don't understand why if leaving my car loaded and available to a teenager causes me to have committed a crime, and you seem
well,
to agree with me
gonna,
on that.
Why
leaving a gun loaded and available to a child should not also be considered a crime?
First of all, I don't think you would be committing a crime in the case that you gave with the car. You might be liable for some civil liability that's there, but I know of no case where you would be criminally liable. Now, maybe they should be. Maybe you want to pass a law for something like that, too. But I'd be surprised if that's the case anyplace right now. But look, there are trade-offs. There's costs and benefits. I think the costs are much smaller than you think for two reasons. One is not only the numbers, as I say, people can look them up themselves at the Centers for Disease Control, but also how you interpret them. When you talk about something like suicides, the vast majority of academic studies that are out there, whether they're done by economists or criminologists, find no change in total suicides when you have gun bans or any type of gun regulation. There are lots of ways for people to commit suicide.
Then why do low, you know, yeah, I'm quite familiar with this. My very best friend through high school, Clark Stinson, shot himself in the head. I have firsthand experience with this. Why then do, well, we're running to the end of the hour. I'm sorry. I'll leave you with the last comment. John Lott, or maybe I did, I don't know. Anyhow, johnrlott.blogspot.com if you want to read more about it. And you want to check out his book, Freedomnomics. Thanks John.
Thanks for having me on. Good talking to you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Even when we run to pressure, it can only make
the storm. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our show, supporting your radio station, and our advertisers. Whoa, where did he come from? Time now for... I get too excited. I push the wrong buttons. Our Jaws alert for the day. Look out. Yeah, in the Maldives... The president-elect of the Maldives wants to set aside funds to buy a new homeland as rising sea levels threaten to submerge the island. He's already broached the idea of buying land with a number of countries and found them to be receptive. They're talking to Sri Lanka and India in particular, although they're also considering unoccupied land in Australia, an entire country that may vanish because of global warming. No, I'm not making this up. By the way, I mentioned earlier... that high oil prices might be the thing that pushes us into some new energy source. And several folks in the chat room, thanks so much for the link. In fact, let's see if I can credit the person. It might have scrolled. Yeah, it's scrolled off the board now. But anyway, the black silicon could revolutionize solar cell technology. Andrew Williams writing at cleantechnica.com. A newly discovered material called black silicon is between 100 and 500 times more sensitive to light than conventional silicon and could be used to revolutionize solar energy generation. Good news. I mean, this is cool stuff. There's a lot that could be coming on in the future. Jeff in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Jeff, thanks for calling the show. What's up?
Tom?
Yes, you're on the air, Jeff.
Yes, this is Jack. I'm calling from Arizona.
Oh, Jack, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just calling because I'm curious why in the United States does gun ownership and use get such a special break? The reason I say this, for example, I'm an amateur radio operator, and there's all sorts of regulations put on its use by the FCC. And also there's a organization of users called the American Radio Relay League.
The ARRL.
Yeah, they cooperate with the FCC to limit and restrict use, because everyone understands this is a limited public good. And if someone is abusive, like, say, for example, transfers with too much power, they limit the use to everyone else.
Right. Jeff, speaking as a ham, my call is WA8MWL, or at least it was. My license expired during the years I was living in New Hampshire, and I missed the five-year window to renew it. But I got my novice ticket when I was 13 and my general when I was 14.
Wow.
What's your call?
KE7VOU.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, so I guess we have a QSL here. in any case, those restrictions on ham radio activity are largely to allow for commercial activity, you know, so we don't interfere with broadcast or other frequencies and you know, for rationality within ham radio. I'd say probably cars are a better example. If you need to prove competence before you can drive a car. And the reason why is not because you have to prove that you are competent at driving a car to be able to transport yourself, because you don't need a driver's license to take a bus, and you don't need a driver's license to walk. The reason why you need a driver's license uniquely to drive a car is because a car can be used to kill somebody else. It can cause injury to others.
And that's
why we demonstrate competence. Then why wouldn't it make sense for us to say, if you are going to own or use a weapon, you must first demonstrate competence. And I'm frankly surprised that, you know, much like the ARRL promotes ham radio activity, that the NRA has, of which I'm a member, by the way, I got my NRA membership from going through a gun safety course years and years ago and just always hung on to it and keep up with what's going on. Although I recognize it's basically the lobby for the gun manufacturing industry. As much as it pretends to be a grassroots group, that's really what they're all about. And that's why the NRA doesn't take this position. I think they frankly should take this position, because particularly if they could put themselves in the position of being the guys, sort of like the ARRL does, who publishes manuals, you know, the pre-test manual. If you're going to take your test, for particularly for something like the advanced license, you know, you go to the ARRL and say, you know, give me the book, right? You'd think that the NRA could make some serious money teaching people how to, you know, certifying people for gun safety so that they could get a license to own and use a firearm.
Yeah, and also the NRA would also be promoting good use of firearms and a good image of firearm use to the public, saying, hey,
right.
look, We want it to be a good something that's useful, that's good, and that's safe. And it's also the people who do use guns are competent, insane people.
Yeah, let's just be rational about it the same way we are about cars. That's frankly a far more radical gun control position than most politicians will take. You know, and it just seems common sense to me. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. And 73, it's good talking to you. Great to hear from you. Another ham radio operator. Lee in Pinckney, Michigan. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hi. I'm just calling, number one, I agree about the guns. And just so you realize, I bought a gun that was manufactured in Canada. And the hammer locks. I have a little key and the hammer locks, but that wasn't what I was calling about.
Right.
You had a fella on earlier.
In other words, the lock is built into the gun.
Right, built right in, and I can lock it when it's loaded.
That's right. And this would not be, not only would it not be impossible to mandate or enforce for that matter, but it's already being done in countries like Canada.
That's it, exactly. But anyhow, the real reason why I called was the appraiser earlier really kind of got me, because while he may be honest, and I agree, he sounds like he is, I'm a realtor in Michigan. I lived with a loan officer, and he was the guy I used for all of my mortgages when I had a buyer. He worked for a mortgage broker who had numbers of appraisers who honestly stood there and told their company that if they could not find the the sale price value on a house, they would not charge for the appraisal.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Now, were these licensed appraisers?
They were licensed appraisers, sure. That's all they were allowed to use, and they did use them. At this point in time, I understand that this guy probably is honest, and, you know, he's got a reason to feel like he's being blamed for something. But you know what? There's blame to go around. There were realtors out there, mortgage guys out there, and appraisers out there that were all doing this to us.
Yeah, yeah. Well said. Well, I guess there's enough villains to go around.
That's the way I felt about it, and I just didn't want him, because he sounded like he was protecting an industry. Really, the only one he needs to protect is himself.
Yeah, there you go. We need a little more integrity and a little more public service and public spirit. Lee, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Sean in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Sean.
Yeah, Tom. Again, I appreciate your show, and I think your show has been a terrific influence in getting people to see their light and vote for Obama to make a change. But what I'm calling about is I think people have fallen asleep a bit here. We have had the most corrupted administration in history. I don't know if maybe...
Well, even before that, Sean, it started with a coup d'etat. I mean, to have a Supreme Court decide an election which is not in the Constitution.
Now, you think about for a second, I mean, can you imagine these people were telling us, be afraid? I mean, can you imagine how incredibly this, I run out of the vocabulary to call these people, but they were.
Well, let me share a little bit with you, Sean. This is George W. Bush. This is a montage from George W. Bush speaking to the Republican convention in 2004.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. Evil terrorists, danger, doomed killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy. May God bless you. Evil God, Iraq, darkness, the continuing danger of terror.
I mean, this goes on for 2.5 minutes, and it's just,
Tom, when you think about Winston Churchill for a minute, he said, we'll fight him on the beaches, we'll fight him on the mountains. I mean, talking about the difference, about being a leader, for Christ's sake. So what really bothers me that people are getting complacent about the fact that these people should be prosecuted. These people should be squashed.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Sean. And this is where the mistake that we make is by calling for the immediate prosecution of George W. Bush. When you go after a mafia kingpin, and I've seen this. My wife, to whom today I've been married 36 years. Happy anniversary, Louise. My wife, when she was a teenager, when we were dating, her dad was the assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. And he was prosecuting the Lickett-Volick crime family. And I was, 17 and Louise was 15, and we had to sneak around the state police who had her house staked out, to see each other. And the way that, Bob conducted that investigation, her dad, the way that they did that was they got the guys at the bottom. They got the grunts, and they got them to flip, and they worked their way up the food chain. And that's what we need to be doing now. We need to be going after the guys. This Tim guy, Tim Griffin, I think his name was, who worked for Karl Rove, who you know, in testimony before Congress, was identified as the guy in charge of caging. I mean, let's go after this guy. Let's start at the bottom. Let's go after Bill Canary down in Alabama, you know, the guy who went after Don Siegelman.
I totally agree with you, Tom. But what I'm saying to you is, like, people are getting complacent. I mean, you know, when they're talking about unification and so forth, yeah. I believe that unification is wonderful, but we have to make justice do its job, for Christ's sake. I mean, these people were above the law so what do you tell your children? Oh, you know, be like our president so you can be a corrupted liar.
No, absolutely right. No, Sean, you're singing my song. You're absolutely singing my song. And, you know, what FDR had to say?
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
See? Enough of the fear already. But we need justice.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Thing it is. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, and there's that music I was wondering. Our China alert for the day, yes. China could be the first country. I love this song. This is from an opera I saw when I was living in Beijing. As I recall. But a woman whose husband goes off to sea, as I recall. If you speak Chinese, you can probably tell me. Anyhow, China could be the first country to classify internet addiction as a clinical disorder, amid growing concern over compulsive web use by millions of Chinese. So look out. Maybe it's just that they don't want their people on the web, you know. There is that to think about. Oh, my. Stacy in Los Angeles. Hey, Stacy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm always amused when John Lott is on anybody's show, but I just want to make a couple observations.
Mm-hmm.
He has a book called More Guns, Less Crime.
Right.
I'm going to write a book. It's going to be called More Cars, Less Traffic. I mean, the That's my other group right after I start, after the Molly's crack up when I hear the Jews for Jesus. I always want to start another group called Vegetarians for Meat.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
It's just preposterous. But I know you don't live in L.A., but several years ago there was a horrible shooting at the Jewish Community Center in the Valley,
mm-hmm.
Where a crazy person went in and he killed several children. There was an elderly woman who was the receptionist at the desk, and after this horrible thing happened, John Lott went on the air and said that if she had been armed with a gun, she would have been able to stop him. But I just want to say, I don't know if you heard this horrible story over the weekend in Arizona, an 8-year-old boy whose father had taught him to use guns was just charged with premeditated double homicide.
Right.
He murdered his father and a tenant in the house they lived in. There's a reason we don't let kids drive. There's a reason we don't let kids vote. They don't have the judgment, and they have no business using guns. And when you hear over and over again all these horrible stories about parents who are either responsible or irresponsible, but they have guns in the home, guess what? Kids find them.
Yeah.
Why is it so much to ask that they have a safety lock? I just want to ask you another rhetorical question. How many people do you know who own a gun who use it often enough that if there really were an emergency, an intruder came in the home, would actually have the presence of mind and the wherewithal to use that gun and accurately defend himself. What happens, as you know statistically, is that the guns are taken from them by the bad guys.
Yeah, it's few and far between. Mostly you find law enforcement officers would have that. I mean, you know, because they're so comfortable and familiar with carrying and using a firearm. Yeah.
I had a friend years ago. She was the ladies' national champion skeet shooter. Mm-hmm. She could wake up out of a dead sleep and shoot somebody, but I don't know too many other people who could do that.
Yeah, yeah. And with regard to cars and guns and things like that, I think that there is something to be said for taking away the mystery for kids and you know, making them real. I mean, all of my kids, long before they were 16 years old and eligible to drive legally, at various times, you know, we always, not always, but we used to live way out in the country, outside Lansing, Michigan, and when our kids were young. And when we lived in New Hampshire, we lived on a couple hundred acres on the back end of a huge lake, you know, with about a 3-mile dirt road to it. And I taught my kids how to drive long before they were legally eligible to drive, just so that they would have some familiarity with the car. I don't know that I have any good rationalization for that, but it just seemed like a good idea at the time. And all three of our kids, when they were teenagers or younger, have been at a firing range and handled a weapon and fired a weapon. But I don't make a fetish out of it. You know, I don't keep guns in the house. I never have. I think that we need to demystify this stuff and because it's almost like it's a religion. It's almost like it's a cult, you know. So anyway, Stacy, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it. Prez in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Prez.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot. I appreciate that last call. I think there's a certain amount of romance of the frontiersmen and involved with the guns and everything. But
yeah,
the reason I called was it was about indictments and impeachment. And I would say that people that want to find out about the coup in 2000 and 2000 would just read Bugliosi's book, The Betrayal of America. They acted out of their jurisdiction, and they could and should be impeached for that.
Oh, the prosecution of George W. Bush for murder.
That's his latest book, yes.
Yeah.
But the betrayal of America is all about the Supreme decision of 2000. But the reason I called was I want to urge people to call their congressmen and ask for indictments, especially of the Whig group, the inner Iraq group, and there's the underlings like Addington and Feith and those people. Start with them. But we need to start this in the lame duck session of Congress. We need to stop these pardons as much as possible. This is important.
We talked with John Dean about this last week, and he said that he felt that even if George Bush was under impeachment, you know, under if there was a formal charge of impeachment being brought forward by the House of Representatives, that wouldn't stop him from pardoning the people who were involved with this crime.
Who said this?
John Dean, who's a constitutional scholar for whom I have tremendous respect and who worked in the White House with Richard Nixon when Nixon was impeached.
Oh, John Dean, you're saying?
Yeah, John Dean.
Yeah, I didn't hear that.
Nixon's lawyer.
Sorry about that. I've been pushing for this for a while. But
I thought that this, you know, Press, I thought this was the solution to everything, too, and it turns out it's not. There's, you know, this one kingly power left in the Constitution of pardon that the founders were very ambivalent about, and there was a lot of controversy over, and looking back, probably never should have been in there. Coming up tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNS News. We will be discussing the new incoming Obama administration. And Dr. Paul Simon, orthopedic surgeon turned dairy farmer, will be here with some surprising information about real milk. Yes, not all milk is created equal. That plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.